We're gonna start, and we'll just, do our best. Did you get it in an email? Did you get the source sheet in an email? Yeah.
Yes.
So you can open it and see it. It's not as convenient as seeing it all together on the same screen, but at least you can. And for those of you who don't have it, I apologize, and I will read it carefully out loud as I go. And hopefully Maxine will sign in or somebody will sign in and change that at some point. But for now, I am going to get on with that because this is our time and I don't want to waste it. So welcome everybody for our penultimate episode of our course about the Book of Genesis. And this is a big one. This is one of the heavy hitters. This is also very timely because we're reading the relevant parsha right now. About the sale and recovery or reunion of Joseph and his brothers. And in many ways, this story unit that kind of closes the narrative of Genesis is the, how to put it, it's like the sea that all the rivers go to of this book. We saw relationships between brothers. From Cain and Abel, and then we saw with Isaac and Ishmael a little bit more so with Jacob and Esav, a little bit with Rachel and Leah, and now we're hitting a big, juicy story of siblings that lasts over many years that we can really dig into and unpack many things from. We saw in the book many stories about exile, about people exiled from their home, from the very first couple. And today we will read about the exile that led not one individual, as in the case of Abraham and Sarah, or two individuals, or in the case of Jacob running away to Haran, but rather to the exile that became the definitive experience of the Jewish people, since it's the exile from which we came out as a nation in the Exodus. And last but not least, we saw, time after time in the family of the patriarchs, we saw a story of choice, of one son being chosen to continue and another son leaving the covenantal story that started with Abraham and the gods go forth to him. And time again, we see that not the entire family goes on together. And here, for the first time, we see a whole family moving along with the covenant. We'll discuss that more at length next time. After we see the estrangement and the reunion in the family. And again, the foundation of a national story and not just a familial or individual story of a relationship with God become possible. So with all of these grand kind of twists in mind, let us go straight into the story. And the first thing I want to say when we talk about the story of the generation that follows Jacob, namely the generation of his children, is that the enmity between his children, the enmity that will lead some of them to sell another into slavery and eventually open the road to exile, seems to have two distinct roots. It's not an enmity that comes out of nowhere. It's not an enmity that comes just because people are feeling got up on the wrong side of the bed, if you will. There's two distinct roots that are revealed to us in the text very, very clearly. And today we will follow them in turn. And again, I apologize that I can't show you the source sheet here, but for those of you who have it, I am now going to, sorry, just a second. I'm opening it on my computer separately. I am in box number one, which is from Genesis 37, verses 1 to 4. I'll read it slowly and carefully. And what I want to show in this particular quote, oh, I see that Elena sent the link to the source sheet in the chat. Thank you so much, Elena. I really appreciate it. Everybody, if you don't have it yet and you want to download it and be able to access it, it's in the chat. Thank you. So what I want to show here is something that perhaps sounds counterintuitive, and yet we already saw it work. What we want to see here is that sometimes the seed of hatred is actually love. Let's look at it together. Now, Jacob was settled in the land where his father had sojourned, the land of Canaan. This, then, is the line of Jacob. At 17 years old,
Could I interrupt for a second and ask everyone to mute themselves? Because
yes,
we're getting
thank you, Rebecca. Yes, please do. Thank you for the reminder, Rebecca. So yes, if people can mute themselves, that would be helpful. At 17 years of age, Joseph tended the flocks with his brothers as a helper to the sons of his brothers' wives, Bilhah and Zilpah. Let's pause here for a moment. It's very telling that when we say Ele Toldot Yaakov, these are the line, these are the generations of Yaakov, the first thing we say is Joseph. Joseph was by far not the first of the sons. He is not the firstborn. He is Rachel's firstborn. He's a firstborn of the beloved wife, but he is not the firstborn. So already here, we can see a little bit that there might be some resentment, that there might be some trouble surrounding the fact that the boy that's clearly denoted as the continuation of his father is not the firstborn. And it's particularly, he's the son of the beloved wife who had way less children. So most of the brothers are not her children. So it sets him as in a minority group and yet as preferential. And then we hear another thing about him. We hear, and Joseph brought bad reports of them to their father. So we already have an indication that there's something rotten in their relationship. We are not given, one could say perhaps that he was retaliating, that they behaved in bad ways and therefore he brought bad reports. But it's very telling that the text doesn't tell us that. The first fact that the text tells us is that he brought bad reports about them. Another seed of possible resentment. But until this point, we do not hear of such resentment. All we hear is, thank you, Rebecca. Yes, Rebecca wrote in the chat, in addition, he does not work with Leah's children, which raises the question, why? It's another hint that there's some sort of division in the household. Thank you. It's a good point. But it is telling that with all these seeds, or with all these possible, I'm going to exaggerate and call it casus belli, causes for conflict. Until this point, we do not in fact hear anything about anybody feeling animosity. All we hear is that there's the son. He clearly is the preferred son, just from the fact that he's the only one mentioned as the first generation of Jacob. And there's some division in the household, and there's some behavior that could justifiably earn resentment. But before we hear that they hated him, something else to come in. And this is what comes in verse 3. Now Israel loved Joseph best of all of his sons, for he was a child of his old age, and he had made him an ornamented tunic. And only here, after we hear about the love, do we hear about the hate. And when his brothers saw, I'm at verse 4, that their father loved him more than any of his brothers, they hated him so that they could not speak a friendly word to him. Why does the love come before the hate? Why is it important for the text to emphasize that Jacob, here called Israel, in his more official leader of the family name, why is it so important to highlight his love to his son? In a way, what the text is doing here by inserting the love between all the other possible reasons for tension and the consequence, the animosity that the brothers feel, in a sense, perhaps why it's drawing attention here is to highlight that love can sometimes be destructive, can sometimes lead to problems. That somehow Jacob himself, with his love, has a role in upending the peace in his household. When we discussed Jacob and Rachel's first meeting a few weeks ago, we already talked about how, or was it only last week, actually? We already talked about how love can sometimes play a constructive role in society, building families, building the next generation, guaranteeing procreation, guaranteeing some political stability. And yet at times, love is extremely subversive and destructive and can append thing and can lead Jacob to want the second daughter and not the first daughter and can create complications in the social order. And in the situation here, we see it more explicitly. We see how a love, not a romantic love, a paternal love, spells disaster for the next generation. It's interesting, especially if we consider that in many ways, this is a return to the first time that we saw the word love in the Chumash, the first time we discussed that before, that we saw the word love appear in Genesis, when God told Abraham, and I'm reading here from the source sheet box two, when God told Abraham, I'm in Genesis 22, verse 2, take your son, your favored son, your favored one. Take your son, your favorite one, Yitzchak, whom you love. Asher ahavta. This is the first time that this root, ahav, aleph, heva, bet, comes into the stage of the biblical story. And go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the heights that I will point out to you. So already there, in the first time that love comes into the story, it comes in the context of paternal relationship with a son, not in the context of spouses or equal partners. And it comes in the context of spelling a situation, of describing, creating a situation where the father who loves the son also brings about harm onto him. In Abraham's case, it's direct harm. He has to take the son himself and bring him as an offering. In Jacob and Joseph's case, it's not as direct. Jacob is not killing his son. He cherishes him. He loves him. He gives him special gifts. But the consequence is very similar. The consequence is hatred within his household that eventually leads to his other sons banding against his beloved, selling him, first almost killing him, beating him up, putting him in a pit. We will read that in a few minutes. Throwing him in the pit, deciding to sell him, selling him, lying to the father and telling him that he died, which in effect in Jacob's mind amounts to the same. He didn't kill his son like Abraham. Abraham also didn't kill his son, obviously, but Abraham was asked to actually actively kill his beloved son. Jacob isn't killing his beloved son, but effectively his own love, his own behavior brings about what to him for many years looks like Joseph's death, like the death of the beloved son. The language even draws attention to it. Later in the story, when we'll have to go back to the scene we read before about the hatred, but later in the story, can I just ask that everybody mute themselves? Can I just please ask everybody to pay attention and to make sure your mute is crossed? I'm hearing a lot of echoes and it's very distracting. Thank you. Later in the story, when Jacob sends Joseph on the mission that will bring him into his brother's power, we hear the following. I'm still in box two in the bottom source, which is from Genesis 37, 13, 14. Israel said to Joseph, your brothers are pasturing at Shechem. Come, I will send you to them. He answered, I am ready. In Hebrew, hineni, here I am. And he said to him, go and see how your brothers are and how the flocks are faring and bring me back word. So he sent him from the valley of Hebron when he reached Shechem. The fact that Israel calls upon him and says, do this, and he says, hineni, echoes the moment when God calls Abraham, and Abraham, after hearing all of this, after hearing God's call, says, hineni, before receiving the order of killing his son. Later, in the same scene, when Abraham and Isaac are walking towards the binding of Isaac on an altar, Isaac says, father, and Abraham says, hineni bni, here I am, son. It's this constant repetition of being present. Just as Abraham is present for God, he is present for his son. Here, Joseph, the son, is present for his father to go and look for his brothers. But in both cases, this moment of someone giving a mission and someone accepting it with the word hineni, is a conduit for a father's love to become involved in destruction. in something destructive and dangerous. The question arises, though, okay, so we understand why in the middle of the description of reasons for... I'm just hearing a lot of echoes. Please double check that you're muted. Okay, everybody? Please, everybody, just double check that you're muted. Thank you.
Can the person with the iPad please mute? Can the person who has iPad please mute for all of us?
What is it?
Anyway, okay, I'm gonna keep going. Davi Linick is asking in the chat, is it significant that Jacob is called Israel when he loves Joseph? I think what's significant here is not just the love. I think what's significant here is that we're not talking about Jacob the man only. We're talking about Jacob, the family leader. We're talking about where the whole register we're entering here when we say, these are the toldot, the generations of Jacob. This is the annals of the leadership of the family as it passes from generation to generation to generation. This is how we saw it in the past. Every time that this kind of formula appears in the book of Genesis, it's not just about relationships between people. It's about the broader context of a certain passing of the guard, of changing of the guard from generation to generation. So I think that what's significant here, and if you look at it, in the first pasuk, we hear, now Jacob was settled in the land where his father is sojourn. And then in the second verse, this then is the line of Jacob, and it quickly moves to Israel. And I think that this move from Jacob to Israel upgrades the discussion. It tells us we're no longer just talking about relationships within a household. We're talking about a broader arena, which, by the way, I think specifically the reason that it says Israel loved Joseph is particularly important, because if we're talking in that broad arena of passing the mantle from generation to generation, then when we hear that that's who loves Joseph, it really sounds as if he's choosing Joseph to be the next leader after him. It sounds like a choice. And I'm saying leader, but the truth is, if we look at the background of the family, it's not just leadership. The brothers have a good reason to believe that if they're not chosen, it's not just that Joseph is going to lead them, they're going to be kicked out. That's what happened with Ishmael. That's what happened with Esav. They left. They didn't continue as part of the family, as part of the ingrained covenantal story. So the stakes are very high. Moving on, I want to point out that, okay, we get it. The love is important. Love can be destructive. Love can cause hatred. Why is it so important to emphasize the ornamental tunic, kutone tapasim, that tunic that's made, that's striped? Why is it such a central and important premise of the story? Who cares? The way that it's written, the way that we see between the introduction of Joseph and Israel's love to him and the brother's hatred, smack in the middle, this ornamental tunic draws our attention to it. And we will come back to it, because what it might draw our attention to is that this is only the first out of many garments that will appear in the story we follow today. Time and time and time again, the story of Joseph and his brother is going to be punctuated with wardrobe issues, for lack of a better word, better expression. And as we follow them, we will see a certain motif coming back over and over and over again. And once we do, we will come back to this moment, to this ornamental tunic that appears in the middle of the love-hate relationship forming in Jacob's household, and see what it can reveal there. But for now, I'd like to move ahead to the second root of the problem. We discussed the issue of Jacob's love, but there's another issue. And the other issue that stands between Joseph and his brothers is revealed in a sequence of events that we hear of immediately after we hear about the hatred. And the sequence of events revolves around a group of dreams that Joseph dreamed and shared with his family. Let's look at it together in the source sheet. In the source sheet, it's in box 4. It's from Genesis 37, starting from verse 5. Once Joseph had a dream, which he told to his brothers, and they hated him even more. He said to them, "Hear this dream, which I have dreamed. There we were binding sheaves in the field, when suddenly my sheaf stood up and remained upright. Then your sheaves gathered around and bowed low to my sheaf." His brothers answered, "Do you mean to reign over us? Do you mean to rule over us?" And they hated him even more for his talk about the dreams. It's the third time that we hear that they hate him. We hear that they hate him after Jacob loves him. We hear that they hate him when he first dreams. And then we hear after the details of the dream. What is it about this dream that invites so much enmity? What is it about this dream that creates this doubling and tripling of the hatred? On a most basic level of just reading the story and reading their brother's response to the dream, it's pretty clear that they see it as him putting himself over them. Just like he is the first son mentioned by the text, just like the biblical storyteller places Joseph at the head of the brothers through the storytelling, so does Joseph, through his storytelling, seems to be placing himself at the head of the household. Not only does he seem to be placing himself at the head of his brothers, his next dream seems to imply that even his parents are on some level going to be inferior to him. I'm going to read on from verse 9. He dreamed another dream and told it to his brothers, saying, "Look, I have had another dream. And this time, the sun, the moon, and 11 stars were bowing down to me." And when he told it to his father and brothers, his father berated him. "What," he said to him, "is this dream you have dreamed? Is this dream you have dreamed? Are we to come, and I and your mother and your brothers, and bow low to you to the ground?" So his brothers were wrought up with him. In Hebrew, vayekan'u, they were jealous. And his father kept the matter in mind. Why he kept it in mind, we don't know. In what way did he keep it in mind? We're not told. Did he keep it in mind as a matter of anger? Did he keep it because he really believed that maybe it'll come true and didn't want to, and he just told Joseph off because in this moment it was inappropriate for him to share it? We don't know. Jacob's behavior is very opaque here. It's hard to watch Jacob and not wonder, you were a less favored son. Your father didn't love you as much as he loved your brother, and it caused so much upheaval to your entire family. Why are you repeating this behavior? But we don't know. We're not given an entry here to anything except his love and the action of rebuking his son. Why, how he arranges it with other things in his mind, we don't know. What I want to point out, though, is that other than the apparent arrogance or apparent dominance that Joseph's stories of dreams seem to project onto reality, the content of the dreams, too, could be a root of alienation between him and his brothers. He is dreaming about things that don't really belong in their world. They are nomads. They are shepherds. This will be emphasized over and over and over again later in the story, especially when we see it coming to conclusion in Egypt, in the land of Egypt. They are shepherds. Their life is the life of those who watch over the sheep who move from place to place with their flocks. And yet, the dreams he dreams are dreams of agriculture, are dreams that belong in a civilization that operates on a very, very different set of rules. The big grain empires of the time, the places that had empire at the time of Joseph and his brothers, were the places that had great rivers. In other words, Egypt and Mesopotamia. Mesopotamia was Abraham had to leave. This was where Abraham came from in order to found a new dynasty. Egypt is this place that Abraham had to go to as an exile and leave. They have memories of those places, the grain places, that are negative memory. They're memories of rejection, of we are supposed to build a different life. if we think about it, Yoram Chazoni, in his book about the philosophy of Hebrew scripture, he makes this case. He suggests that grain empires, those empires that had land and water for growing various grains and wheat, etc., invited a corrupt status quo. Because when there's land, then bandits can come and take your wheat. And then you need to pay some stronger bandit, i.e. the king and his army, to protect you. So there's taxes. And then the king can take over your land and impose even more taxes and even more rules, just as we will see Joseph, by the way, helping Paro do at the end, building a stronger and stronger centralized government in Egypt. And according to Chazoni, the reason Abraham had to leave this world behind and become a nomad and a shepherd was that a shepherd had a certain liberty, the liberty to get up and leave if the situation is no longer what you want to believe. It's no longer conducted for living a life according to your own values. If your livelihood is tied to a plot of land, even if the king is asking you to do things that you find morally repugnant, what are you supposed to do? This is your land. This is all you have. If you're a shepherd, you take your sheep and you go away, assuming you can make it, of course. And here comes Joseph, this young, beloved, favored tittle-tattle of a boy, and talks about wheat, about sheep, about fields, about the world that the Jews, the sons of Israel, left behind, of stories about leaving behind. And then he takes that and does something even worse. He starts talking about the bodies of the heavenly bodies in anthropomorphizing ways. Who does that? Who talks about the sun and the moon and the stars in these terms? The pagans do. The very people, the very idol worshippers that Abraham had to separate himself from, the very people who three generations of the patriarchs had to distinguish themselves from and continue being Ivrim, in the sense of being on the other side of the religious river of the time. Ivri, they say Avraham Ivri, because he stands on one side of the river, even if the whole world is on the other Evel side of the river. So suddenly their brother comes in and starts talking in these pagan terms to them. And Rav Soloveitchik, Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik, in his book Vision and Leadership, that kind of analyzes and compares Joseph and Moses, the men who brought us into Egypt and the men who took us out of Egypt, catches on to this alienness, otherness of the imagery in Joseph's dreams, and suggests that maybe this in and of itself was very threatening and alienating for the brothers, regardless or besides of the arrogance or superiority implied. I want to read it. It's in the source sheet in box 4. The hate which he aroused in his brothers was mainly due to the fact that he stood out amongst them. He was distinct and different. In the pastoral, nomadic, and carefree community where he was raised, his actions were peculiar. His contemporaries couldn't understand when he spoke of a different economy, agriculture, and of people who did not wander from spot to spot. The shepherds heard in amazement this fantastic story. They were taken aback, not so much by the fact that he saw himself as a central figure of master, but by the very story that placed himself and them within a different society, not a pastoral, but an agricultural one. One way or another, whether the issue was more the imagery itself or the way he positioned himself in a position of authority and power over them, it's very true that the dreams set him as separate, as other, in more than one way from them. From the beginning of our discussions of brotherhood in the book of Genesis, from the time we discussed Cain and Abel, we talked about how in Hebrew the word ach, brother, can be completed very naturally to the word echad, one, he is as one with you, and acher, other, the ultimate foil, the ultimate one you define yourself against. Joseph's dreams very much push the relationship into the second direction. When the brothers look at him, they don't see the oneness of brotherhood. They see the otherness that separates him, thus setting the ground along with their jealousy of their father's love for him, for the action that follows. What follows is perhaps one of the most horrifying and famous scenes of the entire, definitely Book of Genesis, but I think the Bible, the scene where brothers are selling their own. And we're not going to read the entire scene. It's long and you can read it later. It's like I said, it's famous and long and you can read it later for yourself. But I do want to start from the beginning of the scene when the brothers who are shepherds away look up and see their hated, derided brother coming towards them. Because the way they respond is very telling. I'm in box 5, Genesis 37, starting from verse 18. They saw him from afar, and before he came close to them, they conspired to kill him. You can imagine, the description here gives you a sense of time and place. You see them in the center of the scene and him slowly drawing towards it from the periphery of the scene. And it also gives you the time, that there's a certain time where they see him, but he's not there yet. And before he says anything, before he has time to offend them or alienate them, they're already creating the plan for what comes. And then we're given the words that they use. They said to one another, here comes that dreamer. In Hebrew, what they said is Baal HaChalomot HaLazeh, the owner of dreams, he who has dreams. Baal is always a slightly negative word because it's tied to idol worshiping. Baal HaChalomot is not just dreamer. It's someone who holds dreams. He has dreams. He hoards things, which of course is an interesting foreshadowing for Joseph's role in hoarding food later. And they don't call him by his name. They don't say our brother. They give him an epithet, a way to kind of distance themselves from him just as he is physically still distant from them at this moment. It's almost as if as the closer he comes to them physically, the more they already talk themselves into distancing him from their heart. And they already come up with a whole plan. They say, come now, I'm in verse 20, let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits. And we can say, a savage beast devoured him, which is exactly what they'll do later, except the killing part. We shall see what comes of his dreams. And here Reuven, the eldest son, Leah's son, intervenes and says, no, instead of killing him, let's just beat him up. And we are told that really he intended to later sneak in and save Yosef and bring him back home to his father. But what happens is not a moment of redemption. What the emphasis is not on Reuven's good intentions. The emphasis is on what actually happens. And what actually happens is, once again, clothes coming into center stage. I'm at verse 23. When Joseph came up to his brothers, they stripped Joseph of his tunic, the ornamented tunic that he was wearing, and took him and cast him into the pit. The pit was empty. There was no water there. Later, and I will just sum it up, they see they're sitting down to eat in verse 25. Then they sat down to a meal. Looking up, they saw a caravan of Ishmaelites. And then Yehuda speaks up. Yehuda is not the leader at this point. At this point, we don't know much about him. But he is taking leadership. He takes initiative. He says, you know what? Why kill our brother? Let's just sell him. Let's just sell our brother as a slave. And that's exactly what they do. They sell him to the caravan as a slave. Reuven, who wasn't there, comes and says, where is Joseph? What are we going to tell father? And then they execute the cover-up using the tunic that they took of Joseph. I am in verse 31. Then they took Joseph's tunic, slaughtered a kid, and dipped the tunic in the blood. They had the ornamented tunic taken to their father, and they said, we found this. Please examine it. Is it your son's tunic or not? Note that they're not saying, is that our brother's tunic? It's your son's tunic. He recognizes and said, my son's tunic, a savage beast devoured him. Joseph was torn by a beast. The brothers are doing something very clever. They're not even lying here. they're obviously deceiving him, but they're not lying. They're not saying, oh, Joseph was eaten. Oh, Joseph was devoured. They're saying, do you recognize this tunic? And they let Jacob convince himself of the cover-up story all on his own, which is a very clever way of manipulation. What we see in the story, other than the horror of brothers doing all of that, is that the use of the tunic is to disempower when they take it off Joseph and deceive. And as we will see, this role repeats itself two more times in the story. But before we see that, I do want to point out that inside the text we read right now, the biblical storyteller doesn't insert opinions. The biblical storyteller doesn't bother telling us, this is a bad thing to do, never do that. The biblical storyteller trusts us to figure it out. But the biblical storyteller does give us slight detail that emphasizes the horror. And this is in verse 25, when immediately after throwing Joseph to the pit, we hear, then they sat down to a meal, which in Hebrew is three words exactly. Vayeshvu, they sat down, le'chol, to eat, lechem, bread. With three words, we are given a horrifying picture of emotional apathy. We are given a moment when we see these people, their brother in the pit, presumably screaming or cold or hurt or scared, and they are sitting and breaking bread together, which is a universal symbol of peace, of agreement. They are at peace. They are comfortable. They are sating their hunger. He is there. Later, way, way, way later in the Bible, in Megillat Esther, we will see a similar moment when, after sending the horrible decree to the entire kingdom, telling them to kill all the Jews at a particular date, we hear that, and I'm in the same box, the couriers went out post haste on the royal mission, and the decree was proclaimed in the fortress Shushan. The king and Haman sat down to feast. The same kind of coldness, the same kind of emotional blockage or emotional disparity, emotional gap between a terrible tragedy happening and the ability of the people orchestrating it to set it aside and sit down and just eat. Okay, thank you very much. I see that I now have the ability to share screen. So here I am. Okay. Now, to emphasize, perhaps, that the role of clothes here is to deceive and disempower, the next two stories we hear, one about what happens to Yehuda after the sale of Joseph, and one about what happens to Joseph about the sale after the sale of Joseph, both center about clothes again. We don't have time to do it in detail, so I'm going to just condense it here and just... it's in the source sheet. You can look at it later. Before we hear anything about Joseph's life in Egypt, we hear about Yehuda. Yehuda yored mi'im echav. He goes down. He goes away from his brothers. The rabbis and the commentators all point out to that fact that he goes away, that he leaves the family to show that the sale of Joseph, the horrible crime the brothers committed together, and Jacob's sorrow and inconsolable mourning that follows causes the brothers to break apart. Judah, who took a leadership position by initiating the sale, even though it mitigated what would have been worse, which was killing Joseph, is still becoming a scapegoat for his brother's guilt. And he can no longer dwell with them. He goes away, he marries a Canaanite woman, he builds a whole life with her, he has three sons with her, and then he marries the eldest son to a Canaanite woman named Tamar. But God doesn't like the first son, and the first son died. So, in accordance to the customs of the time and Levirate marriage, Tamar is given to the second son, and the second son dies too, again, by God's initiative. At this point, Yehuda, who's scared of losing his last youngest son And imagine the trauma. Imagine the fear involved in that moment after losing two sons like that in quick succession. Tells Tamar to wait. He'll give her the son later. He's too young now. But even as the son grows up, he never brings about the marriage. According to the customs of the time, Tamar is considered betrothed, almost married practically, to the youngest son. So she can't marry anybody else. And yet she's not given in marriage. She's not taken by the son. So she can't build a family. She is the ultimate chained wife. She can't have children. She can't build a family and continue the world. And eventually she takes matters into her own hands. When she hears that her father-in-law is going to be passing somewhere not far from where she is, she does the following. She takes off her widow's weeds, her clothes of widowhood, and dresses up as a prostitute, which at the time apparently meant having yourself covered except your eyes. Today, you know, prostitution we associated was revealing your body. Then it was hiding. It's shameful. It's not it's something that will be shared in the tent, not out in the public. She dresses as a prostitute. Yehuda does business with her. When she becomes pregnant, of course, she takes off the prostitute's clothes, puts again widowhood clothes. When it becomes revealed that she was unfaithful to the youngest son since she becomes pregnant, and Yehuda is about to kill her, to execute her, as is his right, since she shamed his family, she sends him what she accepted from him as collateral in her role as a prostitute, which is his identifying marks. She says, "Do you know whose are these? These belong to the father of my child," echoing what the brothers did with the ornamental tunic, sending it to their father, and not saying Joseph is dead, but rather saying, "Do you recognize it?" So she's saying, "Do you recognize it?" And Yehuda famously, instead of just letting her die or hiding the situation, publicly acknowledges Tzedakah Mimeni. She is more right than me. And this is how his line continues. She has twins, and one of these twins is the great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather of King David. Once again, clothes, specifically in this case, the clothes of a prostitute, are used to disempower and deceive. They disempower Yehuda because they take away his ability to make informed choices about Tamar, his daughter-in-law, and they deceive him to the point that he makes the choices she wants to make. The biblical storyteller does seem to imply that in this case, it's a negative. It's a positive thing, since the proof is in the consequence. The consequence is a very cherished bloodline that will lead all the way to King David. But the usage of the clothes is once again, just as in the case of the brothers taking it off Joseph, dipping it in blood and sending it to their brother, to bring about some sort of game of deceit and recognition that manipulates another. In the very next chapter, we hear about what happened to Joseph in Egypt. And at first, things seem to be going pretty well. He is taken by a rich man named Potiphar and is treated as a beloved member of the family. The most important of the slaves. Potiphar gives him full trust to manage the estate. But then Potiphar's wife demands that he sleep with her. And eventually, when she's alone with him, she grabs onto his tunic and he runs away. And in order to run away, he leaves his tunic with her. And she uses this tunic to concoct a story that he forced himself upon her. He, the slave, the Hebrew slave, the foreigner, she uses very strong language in that scene. He, the Hebrew slave, raped me. And here's this tunic as proof. Once again, clothes are used to deceive and to manipulate and to disempower Joseph because the consequences of her enraged husband throws him into jail and takes away all the power he had before them. When we see in such quick succession, three times when clothes are used like that, when we remember that the word for clothes in Hebrew, beged, is the same word as betrayal, when we remember that the very first time that clothes were ever mentioned in the story of Genesis is also related to a moment of betrayal and hiding, namely the following moment in Eden. I am reading from box 3 here. Then the eyes of both of them, after they ate the forbidden fruit, were opened, and they perceived that they were naked, and they sewed together fig leaves and made themselves loincloth. Not only do they hide their nudity, they hide themselves from God himself. They heard the sound of the Lord God moving about in the garden at the breezy time of day, and the man and his wife hid from the Lord God among the trees of the garden. When we recall all of that, when we see that clothes are almost by their nature, and definitely in terms of precedent in the book of Genesis, tied to hiding, hiding identities, deceiving, we have to go back to the beginning of the story. We have to go back to the moment when Joseph receives the ornamental tunic from his father and ask, does this moment fit into the pattern? Can this moment be conceived of or perceived of as part of the same sequence? On the face of it, the answer is no. On the face of it, unlike in all the subsequent usages of clothes in the story of Joseph and his brothers, Jacob uses the ornamental tunic not to deceive, but rather to reveal. This is a way for him to show his feelings, to show his love. It's an expression. Also, it's not a way to manipulate someone. He's not trying to take away power from Joseph. He's trying to give him a sign of his favor. And yet, even though it looks so positive and honest on the face of it, when we look at this short instance here, I'm at box 1, verse 3. Now, Israel loved Joseph best of all his sons, for he was the child of his old age, and he had made him an ornamental tunic. When we look at it in this context, we can't treat it as so very benign. And we can see already there that without Jacob's intention, he is sowing a seed of tragedy. Because while it's a revealing and not a hiding moment, and while it's an empowering and not a disempowering moment, it is disempowering the other brothers. It is taking away from them their status as equal brothers to Joseph. By bringing Joseph up, Jacob is achieving what the other people achieve by taking something. He's giving something, but he achieves the same because what he takes is a sense of equality from all his other sons. Is it truly any wonder that later, when Joseph comes and explicitly shares dreams that place him above them, they are so ripe to be angry? If those dreams are, in a sense, an echo, subconscious, perhaps contrived in their opinions, but an echo of the reality of their life, a reality that's created by their father's uneven love and the clothes that represent it. One way or another, whether you want to accept this reading or not, we watch a moment where the normal solidarity, the normal affection that should and is expected to exist between brothers is eclipsed to the point that brothers can sit and eat bread while their brother is suffering. And in many ways, the real wonder of the book of Genesis is that there's any way back from this. For many reasons. How can the brothers ever look Joseph in the eyes again? How can they ever reach out to him, even if they meet him? Let's say they do meet him. How could Joseph ever love them or trust them again? Joseph goes to his way, and all he knows is that his father sent him on a mission, and then to his brothers, and then the brothers sell him. Does he even know that his father was not on the plot? Does he know that this wasn't a new binding of Isaac? How will he fix his relationship with his father? How can you come back from this series of disasters? So we will discuss that, the way back, at great length next week. And we will talk about three changes that need to happen and do happen and open the door for reconciliation. But before we traverse this road in detail next year, I do want to give a trailer, a sneak peek, with which I want to tie what we discussed today. And the sneak peek, I'm going to jump straight ahead all the way to the bottom of the source sheet. I'm here on the scene when Joseph reveals himself to his brothers and talks to them and comforts them and tells them, yes, I know you thought you were doing something bad, but really God was behind events. And really the fact you sold me means that I was able to come here and accumulate food. And now I can invite you to come to me and save you from starvation. All things that we will discuss how they came to be next week. The pertinent point is that he gives them a context for understanding their past that allows them to live with it instead of being haunted by their guilt. When he finishes telling them all of that, I'm here at the bottom of the source sheet in verse 14, he cries. With that, he embraced his brother Benjamin around the neck and wept, and Benjamin wept on his neck. He kissed all his brothers and wept upon them. Only then were his brothers able to talk to him. Acharei ken, Diburu echav ito. In Hebrew, it doesn't say able. It says, after that, his brothers spoke with him. Why is this so significant that they spoke to him? Why is it so significant that they opened their mouth and shared something? Because the first thing we heard about them, what we heard about the hatred, was that they couldn't speak to him. I'm going back all the way up to source one. This time I'm in verse four. And when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than any of his brothers, they hated him so that they could not speak a friendly word to him. In Hebrew, ולא יכלו דברו לשלום. The hatred, the jealousy, mean that there's no speaking. There's no communication and there's no communion. There's no exchange that can happen between Joseph and his brothers at this point. And at first, it only looks as if it's going to become less and less likely to ever have an honest communication between them. But something has to happen to open not only the gates of forgiveness, but also the gates of communication, also the gates of speech, the gates that were never fully open between Isaac and Rebekah, for example. And yet the gates without which we can't build a nation, because what we're doing here is not just reconciling as brothers. It is laying the foundation of a nation to come. I want to share one more point. And like I said, today I'm leaving you at a cliffhanger, because just like the Parsha that discusses it, it leaves us at a cliffhanger. We don't know yet if there's a way back. We don't know how to fix it. Obviously we do because we know the story, but we don't know how we're going to come back from that. And that we will discuss next week as we tie together this entire course. But I do want to share another small point regarding the issue of speech and why the issue of speech is so important. But before I do that, I'll look through the chat and answer some questions. Jennifer Malvin asked, if there is time, can you review other uses of closing? Do you mean in this particular story or do you mean in Tanakh? Can you speak up, Jennifer?
In the Tanakh.
Tanakh in general?
Yeah, because this was the... First of all, let me just say, you are so brilliant. I am always thrilled by your analysis. Oh, my gosh. Yes, because in this case, the cloak used as Joseph's, the preference for Jacob's love for Joseph. And so I just wondered other uses of clothing like that in terms of this one is revealing, right? But then you had mentioned that there are
hiding or deceiving.
Yes, yeah. And if I missed it, I'm sorry.
No. It's a good question. So it is
and
an
you don't
ongoing,
have to address it at all.
It is ongoing. It's an ongoing kind of theme, you could say, in Tanakh. Those moments of dressing and undressing is significant. Not always. Sometimes it's just dressing and undressing. I can give one more example that I think is relevant here. In the whole story of Shaul and David as warring potential kings, clothes come into play over and over again. The first time that David steps up to a king-like role when he goes and challenges the giant Goliath, Shaul offers him his clothes. And at first, David wears Shaul's clothes and then rejects them. He says, no, no, they're too, I don't know how to fight in these. And there's a foreshadowing involved here that really Shaul will, that the kingdom will pass from Shaul to David, but not yet. Mm-hmm. Other Shaul tears Shmuel's coat when Shmuel, the prophet, tells him that God rejects him. And then Shmuel tells him, yeah, the kingdom will be torn just like the coat. Then when Jonathan and David form a friendship, Jonathan gives clothes, his own clothes, to David as a form of favor, which is also a foreshadowing of the fact that David will take his place as the heir apparent, as the next king. So it's definitely something that comes back over and over again. I think here it's particularly densely preoccupied with deception. Of course, there's also the background of Jacob's many deceptions, right? Of Jacob's time of putting something on his hands to prepare to pretend to be his brother. Let's not forget that. So there's also that in the background.
Eliyahu gives his aderet to Elisha.
Right. Eliyahu gives his aderet to Elisha as a sign of passing on his role. iPad, I'm sorry, I don't know your name, but iPad wrote, selling Joseph is preferable to killing him, not just because it is less extreme and final, but selling him as a slave servant reduces his status. It's an interesting observation. It's also interesting because the brothers are saying something like, what is it worth it for us to kill him? Meaning that the compensation comes into play. The compensation they can get from selling comes into play, which is an even deeper, disturbing shade of the story, that they could have as easily killed him, but why not sell him and make a profit at least? You know, may as well just make a profit. Why not? Which is a very distressing thing. I do want to point out, kind of following what iPad is saying here, that overall, the process we see in Genesis, while we see many distressing instances of relationships between brothers, we also see an slow improvement. The first relationship between brothers ends exactly with death, exactly with what it looked like the situation between Joseph and his brother was about to end in for one moment there, when Cain killed Abel. The second story, the story of Abraham's children, is finished with banishment. Ishmael and his mother are kicked out of the house in a very dramatic fashion. Then we see Jacob and Esav, where there's the entire complicated, convoluted competition that ends without bloodshed and with reconciliation. And then with the brothers, we see the selling, but we will also see them coming to work together and live together and be a family again. So Rabbi Leon Ashkenazi, whom I really respect and like quoting, he was in the French philosophical tradition. He was a rabbi in the French philosophical tradition. He says that a lot of the story of Genesis is the refinement of humanity. There's a certain sense of progress, of moral progress, that every generation is offered the opportunity to learn, to grow better. And it doesn't mean that violence, hatred, jealousy disappear, but it does mean that they're not dealing with challenges in the same way. So what we see here is horrifying, but it's still a step up from Cain and Hevel. No question about that. Just a moment. Hannah Gatel Elbaum asked, would not Benjamin be the youngest child? Why does he not receive similar preferment? Were the brothers simply kinder to him because he was still very young at the time? So it seems, it's a great question, and it seems that the answer is just that he was very young. So perhaps he received preferential treatment, but as I said in the beginning, the fact that we're talking here, that we have this subtle move from Jacob to Israel, signals to us that we're not only talking about love and the, oh, baby, I love you so much sense of a personal relationship between father and son. We're talking here about choosing an heir, about preferment for leadership or preferment for being the heir, the person who continues the covenant for the next generation. And I think Benjamin at this point is just ineligible. He's too young. Joseph is young. He's 17 years old. His brothers are in their 20s, but he is old enough to be considered the chosen one of his father. As we will see later in the story, when Joseph in disguise as the viceroy of Egypt demands that the brothers bring Benjamin to him, then we discover that Benjamin became the substitute for him in his father's love, because the brothers say, we can't bring our son, our brother Benjamin. Our father would never let him come down here. He loves him so much. He's the only remaining son he has from his beloved wife, Rachel. We can't bring him down. He'll never agree. And indeed, Jacob doesn't. Jacob prefers to watch his entire family suffer than to risk this one remaining son of Rachel. And we will discuss that and what it means to the brothers and how they handle themselves in regards to that very, I would say, jealousy-worthy behavior that we will discuss at great length this week. I've seen many great questions. Unfortunately, we do have to wrap up today. So I just wanted to finish, as promised, with a comment about speech, about the power of speech, and why it's significant that the story of Joseph and his brothers starts with the power of speech being withheld when the brothers can't speak to Joseph, and ends with the restoration of speech when they finally, something opens and they can talk to him. There's a concept in the sages and the commentaries that, and specifically in Hasidut and Kabbalah, and late, it's developed much more in later, later more mystical streams of Judaism, that the exile we had in Egypt, the exile that we came from as a people, was not merely an exile of the body, it was also an exile of the speech. Galut hadibu. They lost their ability to speak. All they could do is groan. And God took this groan of the slaves in Egypt. We're talking here already the beginning of the book of Exodus, not the book of Genesis, but I'll come back to Genesis in a second. All the slaves, the Hebrew slaves, could do is groan. They couldn't articulate themselves. They lost the ability to discuss their situation, to have identity, to identify themselves through speech, to express themselves. All those things that we associate with communication, like self-perception, understanding where we are in front of others, the niceties of speech, the power of rhetoric, all of those things are out of their hands. All they can do is vayeanku. They groaned under the burden. And God had to go and listen to this groan and say, okay, fine, good enough. I'll take that as a plea for help. And I'm going to go and get a man who has a great difficulty speaking, a man named Moses, and bring him to speak to the, and speak to Paro and speak to the people and bring them to the point of freedom where they too will be able to speak. In other words, the whole story of the Egyptian exile and the Egyptian redemption, the redemption from Egypt, is tied to losing our ability to express ourselves and then slowly, painstakingly, through 10 plagues and many experiences, regaining it to the point that we can meet God as partners in Mount Sinai. I realize that I'm condensing a very big theme in 2 minutes here. I apologize, but I'm just giving you a little bit of a taste of Exodus and its glories. I think it's very meaningful that the story of Joseph and his brothers, a story that starts with exile, with banishing one brother and ends with uniting in exile physically, but as a family, is also a story about losing the ability to speak and regaining the ability to speak. It's as if Joseph and his brothers are living the foreshadowing of what their descendants are going to have to live through on a national level. And perhaps if we have time next week, we can come back to the question of why communication is so important. If not, then hopefully sometime in the future. And on that note, thank you so much, everybody. It was a pleasure to see you all and a pleasure to learn with you. And thank you for coming. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you for coming and thank you for making do. I'm so sorry about the situation this morning. But,
thank you for
it was wonderful. Wonderful. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Pleasure. I'm looking forward for next week for tying it all together.
Yep. Wonderful. Have a great day.
Thank you. You too.
Sure.
Goodbye, everybody.